I've got one after. Welcome, everybody. With the new Zoom rules that just go in effect, I think this week, I'm noticing a slight delay in my waiting room. So let's give everybody just another minute to get in. But thanks for everyone for being here on time. Got a couple of quick things to go over. We'll go through the agenda really quick and just go over it. We'll go for updates and then get into our discussion. So appreciate everybody joining us. Just a note, I'm not going to mute everybody yet. I think when Avi gets started, we'll probably mute everybody. And if you just want to say something or interrupt Avi, or if you want to ask a question, Avi, I don't want to speak for you, but hopefully you can kind of pivot on the fly if there's some questions or people have, you know, interest in maybe going a little deeper on some of these slides. We'll let people just unmute themselves and speak up.
Yeah, of course.
We'll try not to get too rowdy, Richie.
Thank you, Andrew. I appreciate that. Well, let's get rowdy. It's Wednesday afternoon. And nothing more rowdy than interoperability standards. All right, a few people have just joined. It's two after. If anyone else joins, that's great. Steve, I don't know if you want to kick off with a welcome or if you want me to get into any trust guidelines.
Yeah, just go ahead and do the antitrust guidelines, and then I'll say a few words on the DOE connected communities.
Great. So antitrust guidelines are included in the materials. These materials were just updated recently. They were put in the calendar invite. They're also sent via email through our constant contact. So hopefully you got them one way. They're also on the screen over here. Our antitrust guidelines are included for your reference. This is a quick guide. We ask that everybody abide by them for the duration of this call. And now I'll go back to the agenda here and just pass it off to Steve Roper.
Yeah, thanks everybody. And thanks for joining today. Looking forward to hearing from Avi from NIST and John McDonald was involved in that effort. So they've both agreed to talk with us today about that. I wanted to just take a couple minutes to give you an update or almost a non-update on the DOE Connected Communities potential FOA. So as those of you that have joined us in past sessions, past council, tech council meetings, know we've spent a fair amount of effort on this, submitting comments back in the spring, kind of following it, talking to many of you about how best to respond and various things. To be honest, we've gotten somewhat busy with other things, and so we haven't done a whole lot this last month, but I just wanted to tell you that we've been checking as best we can to try to find out what's happening at DOE, and we don't have a lot of information other than the FOA has been submitted up the line at DOE for approval, and I think that may have happened several weeks ago. So it's actually sitting on somebody's desk waiting for approval to be released. And unfortunately, that sort of hints that there may be some politics involved in this. I hope that's not the case, but it wouldn't surprise me given everything going on the Hill these days and with the election, the lead up to the election, that this might actually get held longer until even after the election. I hope that's not true. It could get released tomorrow for all we know. But that's the status. And until it's released, we won't really have any more details than we've had in, you know, based on our previous discussions several months ago. So stay tuned. As soon as we see it released, we'll make sure it gets out to all of you. And we'll probably follow up that with a call for any of the companies that are interested in participating in a team or a proposal of some sort. So I wish I had better news, but that's what's going on at DOE. And I would say one more thing, which it's not just the Connected Communities FOA. Our understanding is there's a number of procurements that for who knows what reason, particularly those out of the EERE office. So, you know, we'll just monitor it and hope that it changes. And as soon as it does, we'll let you know. And I think that hopefully there's still an opportunity there. I think many of you, if not all of you, are also aware that we've launched this project just recently. And we focus more on the Policy Council for this discussion, but we're looking at supporting a request for $25 billion of stimulus money, assuming that sometime in the next few months that Congress actually decides to do some kind of a job stimulus funding action, then we'll make sure that the grid and many of the things we all care about are in that stimulus package. So that's going on as a separate effort. Any of you that want to be involved in that are welcome to join us on our calls. And you should have all received a number of emails about that. But if you have any questions, just send me an email or send Rich an email. We'll be glad to connect you into that process. So that's all I have to say on that. I'm happy to be able to turn the mic over to John McDonald, who is on our executive committee. He's on our board. He's been involved in the Gridwise Alliance for many, many years. I would expect that all of you know John either personally or by reputation. He's certainly been one of the leading thinkers in this space. And in particular, the topic of interoperability is something that John's put a lot of his own personal effort into. And since NIST, with John and many others' help, just released their 4.0 interoperability plan, we wanted to highlight that to all of you, give you a chance to ask questions, and we can even talk about what the appropriate follow-ups might be after this call. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to John McDonald. Thanks, John.
Okay. Yeah, thanks a lot, Steve. We're really fortunate today to have Avi Gopstein from NIST with us. And I'll provide a little bit of background from my perspective, and then Avi will talk to us about the work that's been done and recently posted on the NIST website. You know, back in 2007, we had the Energy Independence and Security Act, and Title 13 basically said what the U.S. should be doing for smart grid. But most important for Avi and NIST was that it made really NIST the overall coordinator for smart grid standards, okay? And then in 2009, NIST received stimulus funds, the 2009 stimulus funds, to help do that work. And that's when the Smart Grid Interoperability Panel was formed. Some of you may have attended some of our meetings or heard about the SGIP, but I was elected to the board of that, and we had our first meeting at NIST in December of 2009. And what was interesting with that board was it represented 22 different stakeholder categories, thinking that smart grid, the landscape of smart grid is from turbine to toaster. You know, how do you adequately represent all the stakeholder categories that should be involved? So 22 stakeholder categories, a board of 25 people. We met at NIST December of 2009 in Gaithersburg. And then the board elected me to be chairman, and George Belovic, vice chairman from AEP, and John Caskey from NEMA, secretary. And so for the next 5 years, really 2010 through 2015, that was our work. We coordinated all the smart grid standards for the U.S. with NIST. We harmonized this work with a lot of other countries. We had memos of understanding with many other countries. The goal was not to have a set of standards just for the U.S., but ideally you want the same set of standards globally, which really fosters trade and commerce, right? We don't want, we want to make sure products we do in the U.S. are understood and are accepted by other countries and vice versa. So part of the legislative requirements in 2007 was for NIST to keep this framework up to date as the industry changes, as standards get developed, technology changes, we need to keep this up to date. And basically what we're saying is, what does the U.S. need to do to be prepared for smart grid looking out, say, 10, 15 years or so, you know? So in 2017, to do the next framework version, NIST selected 11 smart grid experts in the US and formed a smart grid advisory committee. And I was fortunate to be one of those 11. Paul Santalella, a former Ohio Public Utility Commission commissioner, was the chair of that group, and I was vice chair. And when we formed a technical subcommittee, I chaired that technical subcommittee. So from 2017 through September 30th of 2019, we worked closely with Avi and the team at NIST to put the document together. Again, what are the smart grid requirements for the US looking out 10, 15 years in the future? A huge part of that is standards and interoperability. So it was recently posted on the NIST website, a link to the document, and Avi and the team is looking for comments from the public. So I thought this would be a good opportunity with the Technology Council here at GridWise to have Avi, who's led this work for NIST, to give us a talk on Framework 4.0, what we call Framework 4.0. So it's exciting. There's been a lot of changes since the previous frameworks to, as technology and standards and everything have changed. We had a lot of updates. And so let's hear what those are. And Avi, we look forward to hearing your talk, and I'll turn it over to you now.
All right, great. Thanks, John. Very much appreciate the introduction and also the invitation to speak. As well as your contributions on the advisory committee. And you also spoke at one of our workshops in Atlanta, I think about a year and a half ago. So that was very helpful. Just real quick, if anybody has trouble hearing me, my audio hasn't been perfect on this call. So if you have trouble hearing me, let me know and I can try and dial in maybe. But otherwise, let's just get going. I think John actually did a great intro. I won't have much to do from the background content. Obviously, we're going to talk about Framework 4, and we are going to focus on what's new. I'm assuming most of you know a little bit about the previous frameworks. We're going to start with a quick introduction, right, to NIST and what the background of the framework is, but really John already did that. So we're going to go into the value propositions of interoperability and how that is evolving. Then some new models and tools that have been developed for this framework in particular, and then go into some of the content sections, the operations that are changing, the economics of the system, cybersecurity, testing and certification, and really get into interoperability profiles at the end, because that's the most important and interesting thing to come out of this work. So, why is NIST doing this work? Why did we write the framework for smart grid interoperability, and why are we on our fourth version? Well, John already described that, right? It was ESA 07. And I want to highlight a couple of important words in the statute, right? So I want... Our job is to modernize the grid. We're not doing this to keep the old grid running. We're doing this to help modernize the grid. Second, we are to do that without ignoring the importance of the conventional system in keeping the grid running, right? So we have to modernize the grid while keeping it running, which, as everybody here knows, is sometimes viewed through different lenses, but makes it a complicated endeavor. Second, we are supposed to coordinate the development of the framework, right? We don't write it ourselves. We don't write it in isolation. We work with stakeholders and contributors across the power sector and use their input to inform the ideas that we express here. And also, the framework must focus on enabling all electric resources, right? No magic bullets, or no silver bullets, sorry, no magic wands. We don't just fix everything with one technology. We're looking at enabling a modern, efficient, resilient, reliable system. So I do want to emphasize the point of coordinating here. John already talked about what we've done. We hold lots of workshops, but this is also why I'm here today, because as John mentioned, we're in the public comment phase of this framework, and I hope that after we're done with this conversation, you'll head to the website, download the document, send us your comments so we can consider your input along with that of all the other feedback that we get. I also do want to highlight this word interoperability because that is what we're focused on, right? So here is the framework. These are the sections of the framework that are in this version, right? We're going to run through each of these chapters in brief, and then we can have any conversation in depth that you want to dive into, right? But the current framework, I want to emphasize, is founded on some of the similar concepts, some of the similar foundational concepts as earlier frameworks. And we use those concepts, though, in a completely new way in this version, right? And that's reflected in this chapter structure, right? We didn't have chapters on operations and economics in the previous versions. I think this is a good thing because technology is advancing rapidly, and the ideas about how we would use information and communicate information in the grid, they're not the same as they were 11 years ago when SGIP was founded, or 13 years ago when ESO was passed. So what is interoperability, right? We have our definition in the upper left-hand corner, and that's really important for the conversation. It is what guides our work. But conceptually, I think the most important thing to understand is that interoperability is a tool for unlocking new value across the power system. That value can come from improved operations and efficiencies, avoided costs due to decreased outages, or integration of new resources and economic opportunities into energy markets. So, as our grid modernizes, you've probably seen these estimates before, right? The $10 billion estimate that the GridWise Architecture Council put out that could be interoperability derived savings in the electric power sector on a yearly basis. Now, I want to complement that number with the number we have in the lower right, which is when we had our workshops, we heard from individual firms, individual companies, from utilities to OEMs, that they spend $140 million to $1 billion a year per company just on overcoming lack of interoperability. So when we put it in those terms, when we think of how many companies and utilities are involved with the grid, I think the $10 billion per year is no longer an upper estimate. And when we consider the economic opportunity from customer engagement in the power system, it may be significantly higher. So I want to talk first about empowered customers, right? So the traditional utility approach to interoperability is really one around decreasing integration costs for new equipment. In fact, EPRI published a paper on this in 2017, the point-to-point integration cost estimate. It's a really good paper. But, to be honest, that's also a pretty low bar for the value of interoperability. Interestingly, that approach to the value of interoperability is actually undermined by the typical revenue structure that a lot of utilities are compensated for, right? So when utilities are compensated for capital expenses, and studies show that the most certain revenue source and compensation for utilities comes from the return on their capital investments. When integration costs are folded into a procurement, so when the cost of non-interoperability is folded into a procurement, this non-interoperability actually becomes a profit maker for the utility. Now, we're not saying that utilities are actively pursuing non-interoperable solutions, but we are saying that the structure, the economic structure that governs utility revenue actually kind of undermines this value proposition for interoperability. I also want to focus on the fact that with interoperability, it enables consumers to pursue any number of value propositions, right? So that's represented by this diagram, this cartoon right here, right? But by managing their energy consumption and contributions, consumers can pursue environmental benefits, financial benefits, resilience benefits. It just keeps going, right? So this is the new concept of interoperability. We're talking about not just decreasing integration costs, but bringing value to new to different stakeholders and to new actors throughout the system. But in this quest to interact with others that customers are going to have to reap the value and the benefits of interoperability for them, interoperability also does something more. So it's about more than exchanging the typical energy demand or billing data. It's about unlocking the physical capability of equipment to do something more than it was originally intended to do, right? That's called breaking asset specificity. So if we consider the thermostat, right? The purpose of a thermostat is to control the temperature in a single room by actuating an HVAC in response to measured temperature changes, right? That's it. Now we have fancy thermostats with sensors all around the house, but still it does the same thing, right? That's how it works. So, but now consider a communications-enabled thermostat that is interoperable with other systems. That thermostat can be used to manage distribution system congestion, thereby preventing circuit overload and improving system resilience. Or that thermostat can be used to clean our environment and balance variable generation renewables, timing its on cycles for when carbon-free power is available. Or that thermostat can decrease heating and cooling costs by pre-cooling to avoid peak rates, right? So this is how the value flows across the system and outward from an individual. And we're trying to talk about interoperability in that way so we can use simple graphics like this to describe these relationships. And I also want to go back one more time to utility equipment, right? Interoperability is a hedge against the obsolescence of that equipment, right? Equipment that lasts extra long also tends to be extra specified. And that makes it even more challenging to have that equipment do anything other than the one or two things it was originally designed or purchased to do. So just as consumer equipment benefits by breaking asset specificity, utility equipment can be more versatile, can work longer under different operating conditions by enabling communications. So using standard communications protocols to support interoperability decreases the likelihood that still functioning equipment will become either a stranded asset or a reason to avoid system upgrades. These are the value propositions of interoperability that we want to talk more clearly about with all of the stakeholders as we go into the requirements for how interoperability can be improved. So it's in that context that we updated and expanded our conceptual models for the grid. So let's just begin right here. What happened to my computer? There we go. Here you can see the smart grid conceptual model. This has been consistently updated with each framework. The important things to note are that there are seven domains in the system that help people understand where they fit. There are power flows indicated by the yellow dashed lines. There are communication flows indicated by the blue lines. And some changes in this version are that we have more automation, sensing, and control in the distribution domain. Compared to the prior conceptual model, this domain is not only to have more fancy gadgets. I mean, we have a server farm pictured in there, but it also is larger and more central to the overall model, indicating the increasing importance and innovation that is to occur in the distribution system. There is diversification of the generation, including DER domain, and that elongation of the cloud at the bottom shows how some things reside closer to other domains. So, for instance, nuclear is going to feed into the transmission domain where distributed renewables may feed in the distribution or customer domains. And so they're going to be more closely located there. And also we have customer diversification. We used to just show the house. Now we show commercial and industrial customers and automation. But this is a very high abstract cartoon, good for talking about, but doesn't express many ideas in great detail. So this is the updated generation, including DER domain. I do want to emphasize that the majority of this, which is the renewable variable, renewable non-variable, non-renewable non-variable, has limited changes. Those resources were there 5 years ago, and they're there now. The difference, though, is that you can see some of these are going to feed directly into distribution grids rather than always into the transmission system. On top of that, the customer resources were not included in the previous versions. And the customer resources here are drawn originating not in the generation domain, but originating in the customer domain, transiting the generation domain, and then arriving at the distribution domain. Now, each part of that means something in this cartoon. First, by the resources beginning in the customer domain, it's emphasizing that unlike the other resources in this domain, the customer resources may have other purposes. They are serving functions for the customer or doing something else, and their primary purpose may not be to service the grid, such as a coal plant or nuclear reactor is. Second, because they transmit through the generation, including DER domain, these resources are on a level playing field with other resources as the supply and demand balance is calculated and resources are dispatched. It's part of the solution, even if it originates in different domain. And third, rather than connecting at the distribution substation, they're going to tie in at a secondary transformer or somewhere down on that secondary feeder, because they're coming directly from the behind the meter resources rather than tying in at the utility type of infrastructure. So the importance of this is also not just in, sorry, my slide is going a little bit slow in the transition. Let's see if it's going to come up. There we go. The importance of this is not just in the generation, including DER domain, but we have that level of detail in all of these domains. Now, I don't expect you guys to be able to read this, and that's fine. It's in the document. You can download it and read it. But the challenge is, what do these concepts that we're describing with these diagrams mean for interoperability? So the previous version of the framework developed this diagram, and it was meant to graphically depict communication interfaces between key smart grid systems and overlay them on their conceptual model domain, right? It's a pretty straightforward representation of what might communicate with what under a smart grid scenario. But for this version of the framework, we've also done something else unique. We wanted to use these diagrams to explore a more complicated set of issues. And so we developed this diagram, which examines a scenario where a utility might use high penetrations of distributed energy resources to examine how the communications pathways might change. Now, I want to emphasize one more thing. We've gone to a scenario-based analysis, and we didn't develop these scenarios on our own. These are actually from inspired by the Department of Energy's reference grid architectures created by DOE's Grid Modernization Laboratory Consortia. So to do that, we actually developed a number of these scenarios, and they help us explore different aspects of the system. You can see in the high DER scenario, internet and IP routable communications are critical to incorporating the many different devices that we expect to see deployed and utilized across the system. And we also identify all the different gateways that might be in the system as well. But if you go to some of our, my deck is slow on the update. What you're going to see on the next slide when it comes up, I apologize for this. Zoom appears to be slowing down my machine. What you're going to see on the next slide, if when it comes up, is that we have four different scenarios. These four scenarios are the legacy communication pathway scenarios. There's nothing really legacy about it because it's the one from version 3. It's a legacy for the interoperability framework, but it's still representing a smart grid in a conventional utility approach. Then we have the high DER scenario. Then we have a microgrid scenario. And then we have a hybrid communication pathway scenario that we use to explore what it might look like as multiple organizations in parallel push intelligence to the edge of their grid. So the customer pushing intelligence and the distribution utility pushing intelligence and the ISO RTO pushing intelligence would all look a little bit different. Okay, my PowerPoint appears to have frozen up. Let me try and exit and see if I can.
Bobby, I'll take up, if you don't mind, I'll share mine if that's okay and you want to talk through it.
Yeah, sure. If you want to do that, sorry about my PowerPoint. We can definitely do that.
Right. So you had moved on to this model that had now has four, I think, through some of these.
Yeah, that one right there. Okay. So we're on that one right now. I'm going to try and close out my system. A shame. Sorry, everybody. But these are the four different scenarios, right? And so we use each of these to explore different aspects of what's going on in the system and how the different technologies, the different operational strategies, the different architectures might affect our interoperability requirements. Next slide, please. Okay, this one, it works better with the animations, but we're gonna get through it right here. Real quick, with a more complex grid, we need a finer language to talk about it, right? So the NIST Smart Grid Cyber Physical Systems office released a cyber physical systems framework, sorry. And that framework lists aspects and considerations for any cyber physical system. And what we did is, you know, we thought about if we talk about moving intelligence to the edge of the grid, right? I just used that term. But if we talk about that in these 51 different aspects and considerations for the for cyber physical system, realize that the term intelligence relates to a dozen or more of these different terms, right? For intelligence, you need to sense something. You have to know something about the system. You have to be able to actuate, and actuation is different from control. You need to communicate. You need to be time aware, otherwise it's not intelligent. And it, you know, so there are all these things that are part of a system that need to be part of a system that is moving towards intelligence. So this language, this ontology, next slide please, we actually created a set of definitions for each of these terms. And what you can see is you have the aspect, there's 9 different aspects, and the concern, and then the description from the cyber physical systems framework. And then we have all of the discussion about how this relates to the grid and what's the architectural significance. So this ontology is a way to make our language about the system more precise, which will help us in establishing our interoperability requirements. Next slide, please.
Hey, Avi, as you go through this, I know you mentioned at the top that you're looking for comments and feedback. Is there specific feedback? Are you looking for feedback on the definitions of this, or, you know, back to this slide, you know, on the application of this intelligence? Is it across the board? Or is there anything specific in there that you were looking for?
It's the entire document. Everything that you're going to see today is included in the framework. And all of these figures, all of these, all of this content, all of these matrices, they're all included in the framework. So when you go and download the document, you'll have page numbers, you'll have line numbers, paragraph numbers, sections, and there's an email address that you can send your comments to, and it will be considered as part of the process.
Got it. Great. Thank you for that.
All right, so we're going to get into operations and economics right now. Now, we have 2 chapters on these topics. We don't have time to go into this, but the most important thing is that this framework is focused on empowering consumers. They're at the heart of many of these value propositions. But as we adopt new technologies and create new applications in the grid, it's going to change how we have to interact with the grid, how these devices must interoperate with each other, and how we must interact with the grid. Additionally, these emerging technologies are creating new dynamics in the system, right? The physics of the grid is changing from an analog system to a semiconductor-based system. And the semiconductor-based system has some very different behaviors. And I have this image over here on the middle right. That's figure 10 from the framework. That's an experiment that NIST did. And we've published research papers on it already. But what you can see is that semiconductor-based loads, these are miscellaneous electrical loads, you know, from a household, these are actually light bulbs. Semiconductor-based loads have very different interactions with the electrical waveform than a conventional system. And now this is an area of research that we have to understand more about. And we're doing a whole lot of research at NIST, but we're laying this out. It's essentially a marker for the issues that need to be explored as we move to a future grid. And it's not, I want to emphasize this, it's not that solar panels or 4 quadrant inverters or anything like that are what are creating these emerging dynamics on the system. It's that the introduction of solid state power electronics in almost all of our loads combined with these distributed resources is what is altering the dynamics of the system and these interactions. And we need to understand it more so that we can understand how we need to observe, measure, observe, and control these types of equipments. So if you'll zoom back out now, we can just, you know, mention again, there's market access that interoperability helps, transaction costs can be eliminated. I've got all sorts of things we could talk about for that, but you know, it's in the document, we could talk about that more. And interoperability improves resilience. Next slide, please.
Hey, Javi, are those in any priority order? Has that order changed, you know, in the just A through E? Are they in like importance?
No, in the document, they're really just organized in a logical flow. I've reordered them here a little bit, right? We talk about operations before we talk about economics in the document. But really, this empowered consumers, that's from the original value proposition. It's not. It's the heart of some of these operational changes that then relate to these other things. It's really just a logical flow.
Got it. Thank you.
After we go into how the operations change and then the organizations change, we talk about cybersecurity for the system. And in chapter six, we essentially split cybersecurity into two. What we do is the first half of the chapter focuses on securing organizations, and the second half of the chapter focuses on securing interfaces. I have all sorts of slides and images that we could use, but we, again, don't have the time right today. But to secure the organization, we use the NIST cybersecurity framework as a foundation. I have a screen capture of that on the right. Then we talk about the cybersecurity risk profile that we created for the smart grid, and then go into the mappings between the NERC SIP protections and standards and the cybersecurity framework. There's actually a new tool that we've posted online with NERC since publication of the draft, and we will include a more complete discussion of in the final version. Next slide, please. Once you go beyond securing your organization, which the cybersecurity framework is an excellent way to do that, it gives you a nice structure for how you assess the risk to your organization and prioritize your investments. We go into securing interfaces. Now, in 2014, NIST published the first revision of NIST 7628. And if any of you are familiar with it, we have the spaghetti diagram. There's a snapshot of it on the right. It looks at all the different interfaces you would expect to see in a smart grid. What we did in this version of the framework is we updated that diagram for the high DER scenario, and we examined, are there new interfaces versus old interfaces in the scenario, and what does that mean? The interesting thing is, of course, we found new interfaces, but when we cataloged them based on their characteristics, we found that the new interfaces were also similar to the 22 different logical interface categories from the NIST 7628. So while we acknowledge there are new interfaces, we can draw lessons from existing cybersecurity strategies and protection schemes to protect them, and we don't need to reinvent the wheel from the ground up. There's more content in there as well, but we'll move on to the next part, which I think is really important for this group. Next slide, please. So testing and certification, the short of it is the landscape for testing and certification is inadequate to guarantee and ensure function and operation in the system today. Importantly, it's not just inadequate for ensuring the function operation, but adhering or conforming to a single standard does not guarantee interoperability. And so because of that, NIST is proposing this idea of an interoperability profile. And we're going to run through that really quickly right now. Next slide, please. So first, right, the value of interoperability. If everything is conforming to standards and it works together perfectly in a plug-and-play interoperability, it's cheap to implement. It's expensive to develop, by the way, but it's cheap to implement for the customer. And it enables the best function. Obviously, if you don't have anything even with mapping or anything like that, and you're just doing point-to-point integration like the EPRI study, it gets really expensive. Next slide, please. We're going to skip this one because it doesn't make sense without the animations. Next slide, please. So now we can talk about what the legs of an interoperability profile look like. So when you put a piece of equipment on the grid, the first thing you're trying to do is you're trying to accomplish something. You need it to do something. There is a functional requirement for the piece of equipment or the system, right? And the functional requirements for an inverter are very different from the functional requirements from a smart meter versus an EV charger versus a microgrid controller, et cetera, et cetera. Also, those functional requirements dictate a lot about the information you have to convey, right? So you have an inverter that's going to communicate one set of things, where a smart meter or an EV charger or, you know, a piece of protection equipment for substation automation or something else would communicate different types of information and different functions. Because of that, hardware functional requirements become the first leg of our interoperability profile stool. The second thing that matters are the communication protocols, right? Obviously, communication protocols dictate whether the information will be able to get to the recipient, right? Interoperability is about exchanging usable and actionable information between devices or systems or organizations. So the communication protocol is critical to transmitting that information. And then the information model is the third leg, right? The data model. That is where we understand then what's going on and we can take action. We need all three of those things in order to have interoperability. But if you look at this case study, right, IEEE 1547, nobody believes that IEEE 1547 2018 is more important than me. It took a standard that in 2003, when it was first published and had one requirement, you know, that these inverters essentially disconnect when the system is going poorly, when there's problems on the system, and we have dozens of functions and capabilities. 1547 shows everybody what distributed resources can do. But 1547 also has a challenge for interoperability in that it says you can conform to the standard if you use either SEP 2.0, DMP3, or Modbus for your communications protocol. And then 1547 is silent on the data model. And so you have three different data models that are implied by those different communication standards. But on top of that, Section 10 of 1547 says, by the way, we also really like 61850. And so in the end, you have one set of functional requirements, you have three communication protocols which you could adhere to, and you have four data models mentioned. So you have literally a dozen different permutations where you could conform to the 1547 standard, but you would not be able to interoperate with another device that conforms to it in a different way. Next slide, please. So now let's think about what this means in the landscape of testing and certification. The takeaway of this is we did an analysis. We looked at 240 standards relevant to the smart grid, and we found that only 21% of them have testing and certification programs associated with it. And even then, the majority of those are in communications protocols. So if you don't have testing and certification, now, next slide, please. If you don't have testing and certification, how are you going to guarantee that even if, you know, let's say everybody is, you know, residing in this interoperability profile number 11, that cloud all the way in the bottom, right? Everybody's going to use Modbus. Everybody's going to use the 61850 data model, and everybody's going to do the 1547 functions of the inverter. Even if you do that, if you don't have the testing and certification for it, you still can't guarantee interoperability. So, and with only 21%, you know, you have like a 3% chance of, you know, randomly combining three different standards from these three legs and actually achieving certification. Maybe it's 1%. I forget the math. Next slide, please. Let's contrast that to California Rule 21. California Rule 21 gave a set of functions that have been largely adopted by 1547 and then some, said you're going to use SEP 2.0 and you're going to use 61850 for your data model. UL 1741 SA came out of that. There's a certification regime, and so you have some confidence and that if you buy a UL 1741 SA certified inverter, you're going to get the interoperability you need. Next slide, please. So that was the concept of an interoperability profile. And what we're working on now with our industry partners through the Smart Electric Power Alliance and some other working groups is we're developing interoperability profiles for managed charging of electric vehicle fleets to provide grid services. Another one that we are just kicking off is actually an interoperability profile for solar inverters, for PV inverters. And we imagine that there will be a different interoperability profile depending on the scale of the system and where it ties into the grid, because the communications that you might want to undertake will be different. Part of the reason that I'm so energized about the 1547 interoperability profile is that, you know, we installed a 5-megawatt array on the NIST campus. And then we installed a custom comms link to tie into the utility SCADA system. And so we spent somewhere around $30,000 or $40,000 to install our comms link. And the only thing they use it for is force majeure. That's it. We have these incredible new capabilities. These inverters can do, you know, anything. And yet we had to install a $40,000 custom comms link and wound up only getting one bit of information that we hope to never use if there's a force majeure, right? So we're not getting the value out of these resources for the grid or for just the investment in this technology that we could. And hopefully the groundwork laid in this framework will enable us to begin changing that scenario. So on the left, you can see the cover sheet of the draft. There's the website where you can just download it. On the right is the Federal Register notice that came out last Friday. You can Google that for instructions on how to provide your public feedback, your public comments. Anything that you send before 5 p.m. on November 2nd will be considered. And in defense of my DOE colleague, Steve, I heard everything you were saying before about the timing and the delay of certain things. I will say that the timing of 5 p.m. on November 2nd is truly a coincidence. There are lots of people who have to sign off on documents before they go into the Federal Register. And we've always targeted a 45-day public comment period. And it just so happened that by the day all the I's were dotted and T's were crossed and this went into the Federal Register, 45 days ended the night before the election. It's purely a coincidence. There's nothing there. So maybe we'll our DOE is having the same issues.
Thanks.
Well, Avi, thank you for that presentation here. I'll open it up, I guess, here. For questions, is that okay, Avi? Sounds like okay.
Yeah, that's great.
Great. If anyone wants to speak up, I didn't see any questions yet from the chat. If you want to send some questions in on the chat, that'd be fine too.
I've got a question, Avi. It's Karen Whalen. I have always it's been always a little blurry to me exactly what the compliance regime for NIST frameworks and rules are. In other words, when, you know, it's obviously in everybody's benefit that there are single standards, but some of your standards then are go out into the Federal Register and become something that is more required? Are they all like that? In other words, with these new interoperability standards, how are they going to diffuse into the industry?
Okay, good question. I want to emphasize that the interoperability profiles are not actually new standards. What we're trying to do is work with industry so that we can understand the use cases for different technologies. And from that derive a set of requirements that everybody can agree to via a stakeholder process so that with this reduced set of optionality for implementation, that interoperability can be assured. Now, NIST does not promulgate standards with respect to the smart grid. We write this framework, we promulgate, we establish these ideas, but it is up to the community to adopt through convening and consensus building processes, and also their member organizations, any of the ideas that we espouse in the framework or that we design in the framework. And that's why, for instance, the two interoperability profiles we're working on right now, the secretariat for those activities is the Smart Electric Power Alliance. And we've partnered with them for a variety of reasons, but one of which is that they have great outreach to utilities. They have large utility memberships. They also have OEM memberships. They also have other groups who are members of this. And we hope through these activities the stakeholder community identifies the appropriate requirements chooses to adopt them. But we don't actually force it on anybody, and none of this is a new standard. Well, of the 240 standards we evaluated, we believe that almost anything can be used or can be accomplished by the appropriate application of the right standards. But of course, if you have everybody trying to apply different standards or different parts of different standards, you don't get anything.
As we kind of, we'll send this out as well. I know that you gave a charge there for everyone to go and download it. I'll make sure that I send this out as well. You went through some things that you didn't get a chance to get to everything. If we had to prioritize some of the feedback you're looking for, or as you were developing this and you got to some places where you're like, you know what, this is really the place that we think, you know, we need the most feedback from, but where would you maybe point some of that feedback that you're looking for?
I think there are three areas that are really important. One is the ontology. If you go through the appendix and look at the words and the definitions and the descriptions, and if they don't make sense, you know, let us know. Or if they do make sense, let us know. But what we hope is that this becomes a referenceable vocabulary for the grid that can help lots of people as you communicate across communities. The second is the concept of the interoperability profile. It's really tough to get it across during a slideshow that's not working, where I can't show all of the fun animations. But the interoperability profile represents, I think, a new approach to how we achieve interoperability. Before, a lot of people would say, well, if you conform to a standard, you're going to be there. And you know, that's not the case. That's why we have the 1547 case study. On top of that, I think you mentioned this to us in one of our federal advisory committee meetings, that just conforming to a standard doesn't get you to interoperability, and you need to go to plug fests, right? But I'll tell you, plug fests, they're expensive, they're time intensive. NIST sometimes goes and develops the test harnesses, but you know, that's not easy. And then of course the information gained from the plug fest, you know, starts losing currency the moment that you are no longer there, because you're developing a new product for the next set of capabilities. So an interoperability profile, which creates an actionable, measurable, and verifiable set of requirements that could be used to assure interoperability, I think would be a game changer, and we really want feedback on this idea. Most people agree with it, but then they say, you know, the devil is in the details. How are you going to implement it? And we're trying through our industry partnerships. The The third thing that I think would be useful is our to look at is our cybersecurity concepts. Like I said, one is about securing the organization. The other is about securing interfaces. In both of these areas, our work is not complete. We have an informative section there on the things that we've done and are doing and the ideas that we have moving forward. But we state, here are the things that have to happen. And we're already doing a fair number of them, but if you could provide feedback on that, that if the public could provide feedback on that, then we'll have an idea and some confidence that the direction that we're trying to take cybersecurity for the smart grid is valuable to the community, is a reasonable set of approaches, and I think that's pretty important.
Yeah, Avi. This is Gerald Gray from EPRI. I just wanted to, lend some weight to what you're saying, because what you're describing is something that we've been doing for the last 3-4 years with some of the common information model stuff around the application integration of that, because I had identified the same sort of problem space. We were really good in being a member of IEEE and IEC, really good at identifying use cases, documenting the requirements, and then writing the standards. And we'd sort of had said, next, you know, like that work had been done. And I referred to this gap between the standards that existed on paper and how they were implemented or adopted by the vendor community was this sort of actionability gap, because there is this lack of a testable implementation. So we went down that same road because I had said the very same thing, that you need to restrict it's counterintuitive in some regards, that the more you restrict a profile, the more you promote compliance and interoperability. And we've demonstrated that same concept in some of our interoperability test. But the thing is, you create those profiles, you still have to do the legwork. So we still provided a test harness. We still wrote test cases. Developers they don't like to read the standards if they've got code that they can copy and paste. So trying to do the legwork to provide software artifacts that can accelerate their development helps with that. But again, as you have discovered or are in the process of discovering, all of these pieces, parts take time. Even after you create a restricted profile, you still have to create these other resources to enable some of the success of what you're after here. So a fair one. Encourage your effort. Good luck to you, sir.
Thanks. That's part of why we're working. We're working with SEPA, with that group, hoping to establish the requirements and have a set of people buy in. What's interesting is that during our workshops, we were told that open source test harnesses would really be the critical element. The challenge is to get an open source test harness from what is currently available in the standards. You know, the options are too great. We just can't get there. We're hoping that interoperability profiles are the first step towards getting the open source test harnesses. Now, we were told that, interestingly, by somebody who would lose a major portion of their business if open source test harnesses became available. Yet that person still indicated that it was such an important issue for the community that it's something we needed to try and support. And so our hope is that interoperability profiles are the first step on this path towards achieving a lot of what you just described, Gerald. Thank you.
Sorry, we're getting to the top of the hour here, but was there one more comment real quick?
I did want to say that is absolutely the first step. And the challenge, and I suspect I know who you're referring to, Avi. It is an important first step, but you can't get there without the test harness piece. And that does take a considerable amount of investment to get going. So, but you got to go through that first step, get the profile going.
Before we lose everybody here, I wanted a shameless plug really quick. In the materials here, Avi, you mentioned, you know, supporting modernization, coordinating development, enabling, you know, all aspects of the electric grid. That's really the work that you guys are doing on this. That's very much in line. And I was hoping I can connect this to Grid Connect. It's our event coming up. We just launched registration. It's free right now. We're really trying to build a huge audience here, and we already have over 125 registrations in the first day of good, you know, legit registrations, which I'm very excited about. If you can click that button up there, you can get yourself to registration and very, very easily in a one-step process register to continue conversations just like this. But I really wanted to thank you, Avi, for joining us today. Very helpful. We're going to need more clouds, I think, but I find those very useful. And so thank you very much. We'll share your slides here and the action request of looking for feedback by 5 p.m. November 2nd. But thank you again for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Take care, everybody.